Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, Chapter 13, Behavior of a Person, and we start with some texts without any purport. So I'm just going to read the translations. 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then we have a verse with some purport in it. Sri Narada Muni said, a person able to cultivate spiritual knowledge to renounce all material connections and merely keeping the body inhabitable, he should travel from one place to another, passing only one night in each village. In this way, without dependence in regard to the needs of the body, the sannyasi should travel all over the world. A person in the renounced order of life may try to avoid even a dress to cover himself. If he wears anything at all, it should be only a loincloth. And when there is no necessity, a sannyasi should not even accept a danda. Well, at least that part we're following. A sannyasi should avoid carrying anything but a danda and a kamandula. The sannyasi, completely satisfied in the self, should live on alms begged from door to door. Not being dependent on any person or any place, he should always be a friendly well-wisher to all living beings and be a peaceful, unalloyed devotee of Narayan. In this way, he should move from one place to another. The sannyasi should always try to see the Supreme pervading everything and everything in everything, and see everything, including the universe, resting on the Supreme. Text 5. Supti Prabho Dayo Sanda.
Supti Prabho Dayo Sanda.
Vatmano Gatim Atmadrik.
Vatmano Gatim Atmadrik.
Pashan Bandham Chamoksham Cha. Mayamatramna Vastunaha. A little secret, that last V gets connected with the next A. Vatmanaha, Vatmano. There's only two lines in these Sanskrit verses. They're not four lines, there's two. So the first two lines are one line, but we just break it up so it makes it easier to chant. It's actually, so it should be Supti Prabodaya Sanda Vatmano Gatim Atmadrik. Supti Prabodaya Sandhya Sanda Vatmano Gatim Atmadrik Pashan Bandham Chamoksham Cha Maya Matram Navastuta. Supti, in the state of unconsciousness, Prabodayo, and in the state of consciousness. So what does Prabodhananda mean? Prabodhananda Saraswati. What would Prabodhananda mean? Yeah, in a state of blissful consciousness. And Saraswati? You heard of Prabodhananda Saraswati, one of our great devotees in our line? What does Saraswati mean?
It's a sannyasi.
No, not really. He wasn't a sannyasi. He was a householder. At least for some time. Actually, maybe he was. At one time, he became a sannyasi. What? Yes, the Saraswati, the goddess of learning. Sando. In the state of marginal existence. Atmanaha. Of oneself. Gatim. The movement. Atmadrik, One who can actually see the self. Pashan, always trying to see or understand. Bandham, the conditional state of life. Cha, and moksham, the liberated state of life. Cha, also. Maya matram, only illusion. Na, not. Vastuta, in fact. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. During unconsciousness and consciousness, and between the two, you should try to understand the self and be fully situated in the self. In this way, you should realize that the conditioned and liberated stages of life are only illusory and not actually factual. With such a higher understanding, you should see only the absolute truth pervading everything. Purport, the conditioned state, the unconscious state, is nothing but ignorance, darkness, or material existence. And in the conscious state, one is awake. The marginal state between consciousness and unconsciousness has no permanent existence. Therefore, one who is advanced in understanding the self should understand that unconsciousness and consciousness are but illusions, for they fundamentally do not exist. Only the Supreme Absolute Truth exists. It's confirmed by the Lord in the Bhagavad Gita. Maya tatam idam sarvam jagada vyakta murtina matstani sarabhutani nachaham teshavashtitaha. By me and my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I'm not in them. Everything exists on the basis of Krishna's impersonal feature. Nothing can exist without Krishna. Therefore, the advanced devotee of Krishna can see the Lord everywhere without illusion. During unconsciousness and consciousness, and between the two, you should try to understand the self and be fully situated in the self. In this way, you should realize that the conditional and liberated stages of life are only illusory and not actually factual. With such a higher understanding, he should see only the absolute truth pervading everything. Namo Vishnu Braya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutai Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Tanamane Namaste Sarasvatam Deve Gauravani Vacharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paskatya Desatarane. We're up to the sannyas stage of life. At least in our Srimad Bhagavatam we are. The beginning stage is brahmachari life. Without actually becoming a real brahmachari, there's no question of being a proper grihastha. And without being a proper grihastha, it's not possible to become an actual vanaprastha. And if one doesn't become qualified, at least as a vanaprastha, there's no question of being a qualified sannyasi. Therefore, when we hear about seeing Krishna everywhere in his impersonal and personal feature, the brahmachari, generally speaking, can hear that theoretically, but to try to apply it is not possible when the mind is not controlled. Therefore, there's a training from the beginning of life where one is not trained differently. If whatever one is trained in at the beginning of life becomes a foundation for the rest of the life. And it's extremely difficult to change it. Now, in the Varnashram system, everyone is judged or ascertained what is their qualifications even at the time of birth. We find that even Krishna's horoscope was made. Lord Ramachandra's horoscope was made. Pariksha Maharaj's horoscope was made. Everyone's horoscope was made to find out what their qualities would be so that they could properly be educated. Now, generally speaking, beforehand, when there was actually culture, when people were actually cultured, if one was in the mode of goodness, the husband and the wife were actually really in the mode of goodness, not just officially Brahmins. Then, generally speaking, their consciousness at the time of conception would produce a soul who would enter into the body and who would be ready to cultivate the mode of goodness. That's the minimum. Because even we find that Advaita Acharya, he had six sons. Three of them were devotees, including Achyutananda, Gopal, and three were impersonalists. So here is God. He has children, and some of them are non-devotees. Some don't even believe in their father. Because nowadays that's common, but 500 years ago, the society was a little bit more civilized. Therefore, Garbhadhan Samskara was not just some ritual performed because people were just very ritualistic back then. But it was actually meant for a change of consciousness, to have a certain state of consciousness. Nowadays, we can't even pronounce Garbhadhan Samskara, what to speak of performing it. Therefore, in this age, the only hope is the chanting of the holy names, offenselessly. Otherwise, bohu janman shavana, what is it? Bohu, if one goes on chanting the holy names of the Lord for many millions of lifetimes, bohu janma shari kirtana, bohu tai sada, nama, pade krishna, something. If one can go on chanting the holy names for millions of lifetimes, but if he doesn't chant offenselessly, he won't get the love of God, which is the goal of this chanting. In other words, this age is so unfortunate that people have been trained up exactly in the wrong way, opposite of what you're supposed to be trained up. And not only have they been trained up, the opposite of what we're supposed to be trained up, but they're super proud of how well they've been trained to become a dog or a hog or an ass in their next lifetime. But they don't think like that. They think that they're the topmost scientifically advanced, technologically advanced society that ever existed. And that everyone else is primitive. So not only they're in ignorance, but they're proud of being in ignorance. And they actually believe that they're in knowledge. They think technology is everything. And therefore, they're creating unbeneficial, horrible works meant to destroy the world, according to Bhagavad Gita. Because they don't know about the soul, they don't know about the super soul. And therefore, when they see training based upon the soul, they become very disturbed because it's a direct affront to their understanding that there's nothing beyond the body. And therefore, someone who's not working specifically to cultivate sense gratification, they take as a threat. Especially those who are asuras, because their attempts to be the controllers and the enjoyers in this world would be frustrated by people who actually had knowledge. If people had knowledge, they wouldn't be engaged in buying these articles of sinful life. They wouldn't go to the grocery store and buy meat, fish, and eggs. They wouldn't be supporting pornography and prostitution. They wouldn't be gambling casinos. There wouldn't be intoxication. In other words, if people actually had some knowledge, the asuras would go out of business. And they don't want to go out of business. They want to expand their business. As a matter of fact, they want their business to be the only business. And they've created a civilization meant to keep people in darkness. From the very beginning of conception, they're creating Varna Sankara, where no one even knows who their real father might be. They're not sure of nothing is definite, nothing is sure. They're creating philosophies of unrestricted sense gratification until the end of life. That is their philosophy. And any obstacle to that philosophy, they're trying to eliminate. And people are so bewildered and fooled that they actually think that the leaders are actually acting for their benefit rather than for their own selfish benefit, because they themselves have the same quality as the leaders. But there is one hope in this age. Kalo dosha nide rajan yastanyeko mahagunan kirtineva krishnasya mukta sangaparam raja. There's one hope, that is by the chanting of the holy names, people can become purified and understand things properly. But part of that is to understand, for instance, we may not have gone through the rigorous training of a brahmachari. We may have been trained up like a hog or a dog or a cat or whatever, that this is the goal of life and how to achieve it. Still, we should understand what the qualities are. Even if we're chanting the holy name, trying to purify our consciousness, we should understand what we're trying to purify our consciousness to, so that we don't keep on doing the same things that contaminate our consciousness. So brahmachari life, they go to the forest and they're living in an ashram. It's not a, what does they call that? Bi-educational? Where the women and the men are being educated together. You know, it's in English. They have not only co-dorms where the men and women are living together. I don't know if they have that here. They even have co-bathrooms. According to them, there's really no difference between a man and a woman. It's just they can't see the difference anymore. That's how elevated they become. They see everything equally. The cat, the dog, the woman, the elephant. They see everything equally. Equally eligible for sense gratification, to exploit. So, brahmacharis are meant to they lived a life of celibacy, which people think is abominable. How can a child 5 years old be trained to become celibate? It's an abomination, they think. What will he do when he gets older? And they were actually taught to respect their teacher, which is another thing which is considered to be horrible in this age. The people in America tearing down statues of all the so-called leaders. Of course, there may be reasons. When you read a history book, the only thing you find out is that people don't learn from history. That's what history books are. And they're full of lies. It's the people who win the wars who write the history, not the people who lose them. The Red Indians didn't write American history. Nor did the nations that America came and ran over didn't write the history. Or the other countries, whether it be any country. It's the victors that write the history and rewrite the history when they become the victors. But the history of modern civilization is simply people, they don't respect anyone. They're simply acting for their either personal or extended sense gratification. And therefore, for instance, someone like Christopher Columbus, they claim he discovered America, as if America wasn't there before he found it. In other words, everyone living in America, all estimated 600 million Indians, were not really conscious living entities. They were just kind of like the mountains or the trees or wherever else. They're unconscious, dead living entities. And all the animals and birds and everything else, because they hadn't been touched by the lotus feet of Christopher Columbus and his crew, they were more or less dead. And as soon as Christopher Columbus came to the shore of America and touched it with his lotus foot, then everything became alive, and he discovered it. But actually, Christopher Columbus was a complete rogue, because he was hired by complete rogues, and he tortured, and him and his followers tortured and killed literally millions of people who lived in the continent and stole their wealth. And he was honored because by the people who got the wealth. Honor among thieves. And that was written into the history because America, that's what it was founded on, stealing from everyone. And it continues in this tradition. But that not only America, but every civilization in Kali Yuga, whether it was the Roman civilization or the Greek civilization, they became prominent not by Brahminical sattvic activities, by simply by violence and expanding their kingdom in the mode of ignorance. And therefore it all fell apart after some time. Now, Brahmacharya life is meant to give respect, but not just to any people. Build a statue for the guru, and the guru is whatever, your leader, was simply a rogue or a thief. No, to persons who are actually in the mode of goodness and can actually elevate one to the spiritual platform of life. That they themselves were acharyas. Sandipani Muni was living in his ashram. He wasn't living in a 5-star hotel based upon his brahmacharis going out and collecting some rice. He got all the rice together, sold it. He was living in a 5-star hotel in Ujjain. No, he lived in the ashram. His wife lived in the ashram. And they took care of his students. He just didn't exploit them. And he trained them in spiritual knowledge. Krishna and Balaram were trained for 64 days and 64 nights in the 64 arts. Just Krishna and Balaram happened to be quick learners. So they got the... They didn't have to spend 10 years or 15 or 20 years in the ashram because they learned everything in one day. Not everyone could do that. In any case, Sandipani Muni, he actually had knowledge of these 64 arts and he could impart them perfectly even to Krishna and Balaram. And therefore Krishna and Balaram actually received something valuable from their guru and gave them dakshina in return and they were submissive. They understood their guru was actually working for their interest, and therefore, Sruida, they were favorable towards their guru. They controlled their mind and senses, and only did what the guru wanted them to do, perform devotional service. Krishna did devotional service to himself, because everyone loves themselves. And Krishna happened to be God, so there's no one else he could do devotional service to. And therefore they progressed. Sudama didn't become a sannyasi, nor did Krishna, but they became perfect householders. Sudama didn't find a wife and go out and invest in the stock market to make a million. No, he continued on with his Brahminical culture and his Brahminical activities, and so did his wife. And only due to the extreme poverty that Krishna obviously inspired Sudama's wife to go and to Dwarka. Otherwise, Sudama followed perfectly. He was sense and mind controlled. He was giving in charity himself, whatever. And he performed sacrifice for Krishna. And he learned that all in the brahmachari life. And that's all he did. He didn't do anything else. There's nothing else to do anyhow. And then Vanaprastha life, if one is actually trained to in knowledge and detachment, then one can fix one's mind upon Krishna and endure the elements of the material energy. Now, this seems rather crude, that what a frustrating life, at the end of working so hard as a grihastha and supporting the other ashrams, then you're thrown out into the forest to endure a life of austerity, tapas. But this is necessary. Now, first of all, varnaprastha didn't just go out, you know, after living as a in sense gratification. The only time they went to the forest was, you know, people nowadays, they go to the forest to have a picnic, or others go into forests and shoot animals. They didn't spend their life doing that, shooting animals and having picnics in the forest. And then they're suddenly in the forest shivering in cold and crying. Why did you know, help? Calling 911, please take me out of here. No, they were trained so that when they went into the forest, they didn't have very much difficulty. Their minds were fixed upon Krishna. It was just a further extension of their being able to focus their mind upon Krishna. They didn't go into the forest, and when it was raining, they were trying to figure out where to take shelter, if they had an, maybe they should have brought an umbrella when they left their house. No, they were perfectly fine because they were thinking about Krishna. They were absorbed in Krishna consciousness. Or a minimum, they were absorbed in Brahman at that stage, or Paramatma realization. And the cold, the wind, the austerity simply served as a further impetus for fixing, concentrating the mind upon Krishna in full bliss and knowledge. And when they were perfect, it didn't really matter if they were in the forest, they were in the city, whatever. Then they went into the city again and they preached. They told people about, appropriately, how they can make spiritual advancement. And people were interested in spiritual advancement, at least in the Veda culture at some point, especially when Srimad Bhagavatam was written. Then they could actually become a bona fide sannyasi after a lifetime of training. But in this age, our only hope is the holy name. But we have to chant offenselessly and at the same time cultivate the qualities of a brahmachari, of a grihastha, of a vanaprastha, and a sannyasi. Obviously, the qualities we have to cultivate in the beginning are those of submission. Therefore, we have this idea of initiation. Try to become submissive to someone. And that person we're submissive to train us to become submissive appropriately to everyone else who can help us on the path. Actually help us by example and instructions on how to make progress on the path. Not submissive indiscriminately, but with proper transcendental knowledge and discrimination. Then, by the chanting, we can become submissive, we can become inquisitive, we can become willing to follow the instructions, service, render service, which is why we accept a spiritual master. Tadvidi pranipatena, pari prashnena sevaya, upadeshanti te jnanam, jnaninas tatvadarshana. That the spiritual master should be able to explain what a brahmachari should do, what a grihastha should do, dana, dhammas, tapasya, adana, dhammas, and yagyascha, how to perform austerity, not austerity, how to control the mind and senses, how to give in charity, and how to perform sacrifice for Vishnu. The spiritual master should be able to explain to the vanaprastas what kind of austerity they should be performing, and to the sannyasis how they can cultivate fearlessness, cultivation of spiritual knowledge and purity. That's what guru is meant for, whether shiksha guru or diksha guru. Whatever stage of life we're on, then the guru should be there to help us come to the next stage, to the stage of pure Krishna bhakti. And it should be practical. One should be able to experience the advancement. If it's all just theoretical, then we don't need guru. We just need a book. But we want to understand the book, so we're not going to go anywhere. In other words, if one wants to make a spiritual advancement, if he knows who's going to help him, then he can actually make some progress. Otherwise, he's just shravam evahi kevalam. He'll just waste his time running around in a circle, chasing his tail, thinking he's making progress. Just a little bit faster and I'll get there. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Any questions, comments?
There's a question on on the internet. How much energy should we invest in discovering our varna ashram and duties related to that?
Well, if you don't know your duties in the varna ashram, that probably won't make any difference to how much energy you put into it. Because even if you found out that actually I should be a kshatriya, so what? Where's your kingdom? Where's the battle you're going to fight? Are you going to go out and prove that you're a kshatriya, find some tiger in the forest and fight with him with a sword? Actually, in this age, we know what our varna and ashram is. We were born as shudras, and we were trained to become less than animals. But we have propensities. We have some abilities and some qualities and talents. Usually it's quite mixed. Therefore, the question is not what my varna and ashram is. Of course, ashram, we do have some discrimination for the most part, that there are brahmacharis, there are grihasthas, there may be some vanaprasthas, and there are some sannyasis. So we should find out what we're supposed to be doing in that ashram. But as far as varna goes, even when we found out our varna, basically speaking, it wouldn't make very much of a difference because we're going to do whatever we're doing to make money to survive in Kali Yuga. But generally speaking, if one has a propensity to teach and preach, then he should teach and preach about Krishna. Don't try to teach and preach about some mundane subject matter, unless you have to do that just to survive. But in terms of acting in the Krishna consciousness movement, we should teach and preach about Krishna being the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and not to become over-puffed up, inflated, that we know so much, just because we know a little about the philosophy. And one has some tendency to organize things, to try to control and organize, and we should utilize that to control and organize the Sankirtan movement. And one has some propensity to make money and accumulate and to get resources, one should get those resources and make that money to apply in the Sankirtan movement, to spread so the devotees can practice Krishna consciousness and distribute it to others. Then even if we're not 100% clear what our varna is, or even our ashram, but we'll be acting to pure devotional service, and therefore one day we'll become elevated to realize that it doesn't really matter what my varna and ashram is. What's important is that I'm engaged in devotional service, trying to participate in and spread the Hare Krishna movement, the movement of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, under Prabhupada's guidance. Then whatever we're doing will be successful. Maybe sometime in the future, when we actually have the proper consciousness at the time of conception, when the father and mother have the proper consciousness at the time of conception, according to their qualities, then maybe children will be born in a particular varna and will be able to be trained in a particular ashram. But right now, that's not the case. Therefore, we should try to survive in Kali Yuga, which is difficult enough, and then try to utilize our propensities, qualities, talents, inspiration, and utilize those in service to the Sankirtan movement. Anything else?
Hare Krishna. So in the shloka there was mentioned that there is neither conscious, unconscious side of being and neither conscious side of being, just absolute, just Krishna. So I cannot understand this, that there is neither conscious as well.
Well, we can say we're unconscious. And at the same time we wake up and then we think we're conscious. But actually when we wake up it's beyond this so-called unconsciousness and conscious state. When we actually wake up, then we're actually conscious. So one should actually try to work on the actual conscious level, not on the dreaming level, nor on the so-called conscious level, which is just a imagination, according to the three modes of material nature we've acquired, which is actually just a different level of unconsciousness, which is more conscious than the unconscious state. It is actually an unconscious state. So we can't just wake up. We just can't snap our fingers and we're awake. So we have to try to hear from the authorities, Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, and see through their instructions and apply it even when we're in the semi-conscious state, so that Krishna will become pleased upon us and wake us up. So we actually come to the conscious state gradually. So as we apply the instructions of Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, then gradually we'll wake up a little bit more at a time, and therefore we'll come be able to more easily understand what's being said, and therefore more easily be able to apply within our lives what the Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra is saying. And then one day we'll actually wake up, see things as they really are, see ourselves and everything else as they really are, rather than what we're imagining right now.
Thank you.
Anything else? Voila. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.